Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, straight from his lunch with D.C. Chancellor Michelle Rhee, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, what's up with the voice, babe?
You don't find it raspy and sexy?
Well, it sounds a lot like one of those late-night callers in a movie about the degenerate next-door neighbor. Hey, how you doing? I've been watching you.
Look, I'll be lucky if it doesn't crack too much and sound too prepubescent. But, you know, no, I don't know. I've got some kind of cold. I think Amber's got something similar.
Huh. The old Fordham germ.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness, Rick. So, so what's new with you?
Hey, baby, we're down to countdown, about 2 months from Education Unbound.
Yeah. Did you know that my article the other day was the most viewed article on WallStreetJournal.com for hours?
In fact, I did. You had mentioned that. And I think you've mentioned that it's been heavily Twittered.
I can't help the old shameless self-promotion.
Tell folks, Mike, where can they find it?
WallStreetJournal.com, Whole Foods Republicans. This is a bit off topic. I think I used the word schools once, but it is mostly.
And what is a Whole Foods Republican?
It is. This is an independent-minded person, college-educated, who would typically vote for Republicans on issues like big government and the size of government, national defense, but does not vote for Republicans because they think Republicans hate gay people and immigrants.
Are they more like NASCAR dads or soccer moms or?
Yeah, no, they're kind of like country club Republicans, except they're younger and they mountain bike instead of play golf.
That's a great illustration for a magazine piece.
Yeah, thanks. All right, Rick. Well, but we don't have time to just banter on and on here about politics, Rick.
Okay.
Plus, I don't really have the voice for it.
No, so. You don't.
Mickey, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Two competing studies are out on the topic of tracking. Fordham's own report emphasizes the correlation between higher scores and more tracks in Massachusetts middle schools, and then the Great Lakes Educational Center reports on the positive effects of detracking at two high-poverty American high schools and in the nation of Finland. With a handful of examples of schools that do very well without tracks, especially some of the high-flying charters that we love, where are the examples of schools that really get tracking right?
Mike?
Well, first of all, I like the Finland example. I think I've now heard 37 different explanations for why Finland does so well on international exams. And so this is the latest. It's, because they have detracked. Our report was by Tom Lovelace. This is Kevin Wellner's policy brief. I think, in effect, we're talking about a couple different things. I think in Kevin's piece, he's talking about why it's important that all kids are challenged at high levels, get more kids into AP. And I think there's broad agreement on that in the policy world. Separate question, though, is whether or not, then, if you're pushing more kids into high-level classes, does that necessarily mean that the highest-achieving kids shouldn't get to go to class with other high-achieving kids instead of getting all mixed together? There, you know, Kevin likes to say, oh, the debate's over, but I don't think the debate's over. I think there's plenty of research that shows that that is actually not so good for high-achieving kids, and that there are real trade-offs here, and that we have to be honest about that, that what might be best for low-achieving kids might not be so good for high-achieving kids.
Mm.
Rick, you got nothing on this? I'm, like, dying over here with my voice, and you're just saying, huh.
I think part of this is partly where becoming Achievement Gap Nation has got us in trouble. If the only metric is, are we closing achievement gaps between black and white, rich and poor, then the only question is whether any particular change is benefiting the kids at the bottom of the distribution. I think that's the wrong question. I think the ultimate question has to be, are we doing right by all our kids?
Mm-hmm.
And that means, are we doing right by kids on the bottom end of the distribution and on the upper end of the distribution? And I think it's entirely unclear that detracking helps the kids on the upper end of the distribution. I think there's lots of reason to think it makes it harder for teachers to teach them well and harder for classes to serve their needs.
And I want our listeners to know, people might say, oh, well, of course, Rick Hess is going to say that. He's on the upper end of the distribution, today. But that wasn't always the case. I mean, as a kid, Rick was a real screw-up. So people should keep that in mind, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right.
Absolutely.
Mickey, topic number two.
In a recent National Review piece, Kevin Williamson writes that what's really needed in healthcare and education is price transparency, so we can see exactly where our money goes when we entrust it to insurance companies, doctors, or school districts. Are we on the right track?
All right. So now, so what do you think about this, Rick? So, you know, in healthcare, we have this debate. Basically, people are not paying for goods out of their own pocket. And even if they were, we have no idea what this stuff costs. I mean, if you wanted to be a good citizen and choose a less expensive doctor, you got no way, you have no idea what your doctor's charging versus other people. So in the education realm, same kind of deal, right? I mean, the taxpayers don't know what we're buying. You know, is it even clear that the people that are purchasing things, the bureaucrats that are in the system, do they even know what they're? I mean, how do we think about this in education?
I mean, so there's a couple pieces here. I think Williamson's intuition is the right one, that it's impossible for people to make smart decisions about whether they're getting their money's worth if they don't know how much something costs. That's just a given. What's interesting, say in the healthcare debate, is as we cover the 30 million uninsured with relatively expansive insurance options. We're actually ensuring that there's going to be less, cost transparency in healthcare than there has been, which is pretty darn minimal to begin with. But one is you certainly need the ability to actually know what you're getting. Then the second thing is that the folks making the purchasing decision actually have to have skin in the game. Certainly it's the case that when school districts today make purchasing decisions on textbooks, on tests, on maintenance and pencils, there's very little evidence that there's a lot of upside for making really smart purchasing decisions, mm-hmm. Or that there's downside for making ineffectual purchasing decisions. And there's also the fact they don't have a lot of good information on how good these materials are relative to the price paid. If you're a parent, mm-hmm. And you're sending your kid to the district school, you have no option like this. But frankly, the key thing to keep in mind is even what we think of as expansive market options, charter schooling or school vouchers, mm-hmm. don't actually get at this problem.
Yep.
You're sending your kid to a school, you don't care what it costs because you're just sending your kid there. And one way to think about this is if you think about vouchers more like, say, health savings accounts, where parents are empowered to make decisions. Do I like this music program? Do I like, do I like this tutoring model? Mm-hmm. And if they don't like it, they actually get those dollars and can deploy them for other educational purposes for their child. That's when you start to think about this kind of price transparency.
Well said, Rick. I'm glad you're finally holding up your end of the show here.
Okay, it's tough, baby. I'm here with a big-time, frequently downloaded WSJ star.
Thanks, Boo. Okay, topic number three.
Detroit now boasts the worst NAEP scores in the 40-year history of the test, and Michigan continues to have the highest unemployment rate in the country. Can Detroit be saved?
No.
Because of the Michigan unemployment rate?
No, I don't know. No, look, seriously, what do we do about Detroit? I mean, this city seems to be in a total downward spiral. The auto industry, is still hemorrhaging money. You've got huge swaths of that city that just are basically empty, boarded up houses. I mean, what do you have to do? Do we have to totally reimagine what Detroit's going to be in the future?
Part of the problem is that it's not clear some of these things can be fixed by policymakers, right? This is kind of the cash for clunkers, cash for caulkers dilemma, is the things that policymakers can do are often peripheral to the real problems. Certainly, whether Detroit can be saved or not is not simply a question of whether the schools can get better. Mm-hmm. Schooling can only be one piece of this puzzle, and the quality of the schools is going to depend on a lot of other stuff that transpires. I will say that I think the notion that the challenge of making schools profoundly better in Detroit is a question of finding ways to breathe new life into the 20th century model. The geographic monopoly of the district, we're going to get more teachers who are going to start in their 20s, they're going to teach for 30 years, we're going to do schools that look like they've always looked. I think if those are the starting assumptions, mm-hmm. which they tend to be, that we might as well just give up now.
Yeah, but Detroit is one of these places where you say, okay, the argument is that everybody that's gone out of Detroit, who could get out of Detroit, has gotten out of Detroit, right? And what you have left are the poorest people who have no other options.
Except Detroit continues to lose people.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. So, so the people, the kids going to Detroit public schools are likely, they're extremely poor and they're in concentrated areas of poverty. And it's not clear to me that there's any solutions we know of out there that work in that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just trying to look for some hope here, Rick, some magic bullet. You got nothing for me?
Education Unbound, baby. This is where I talk about this kind of rethinking.
And your forthcoming book.
Forthcoming book, 2 months. 2 months, people can look and say, well, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. And I still don't think it's going to be enough to save Detroit. But you know, it's maybe a few glints of ideas and optimism.
All right. Well, listeners, if you have any ideas on how to save Detroit, please let us know, because otherwise we're just very depressed here. Mm-hmm. Very sad indeed. But you know what we're not sad about? It's finally that time everybody looks for every week. It is Amber's Research Minute time. Amber, bust that voice.
Bust that voice. All right, here we go. This week we have a new study about how teacher turnover differs between the charter and traditional public school sectors and what might explain these differences. The study, led by a new PhD in economics and supported by the National Center on School Choice at Vanderbilt, uses NCES schools and staffing survey data from 03-04 and finds that 25% of charter school teachers turned over during that school year, as opposed to 14% of the traditional teachers. The majority of charter teachers also left outright, as opposed to moving to a different school, while an equal percentage of traditional teachers left outright and moved schools. In short, the odds of a charter school teacher leaving the profession versus staying in the same school is 132% greater than those of a traditional teacher. They also found that the turnover gap is mostly explained by differences in the types of teachers that each sector hires. For example, charter teachers are most likely to be younger and uncertified, and hence may leave to sow other career oats or because they were not in compliance with NCLB. Charter leavers are also more likely to report than traditional leavers that they were dissatisfied with their previous school and voluntarily left. But then again, charter teachers are more likely to be in an urban setting. Lots of interesting descriptive data to dig into here.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of this, Amber? Does this tell us that charter school teachers are worse than regular
school
teachers?
Absolutely not. And I think he was very balanced, you know. I mean, I think it's a ton of descriptive data. Even if you want to look at the tables on the end that just lay out the difference between charter and traditional teachers, that in and of itself could have been an entire report. But no, I mean, I think he does a really good job of trying to dig in. They did looked at the teacher follow-up survey that NCES does for leavers and try to dig in and make some extrapolations in terms of why this is happening. And I think they brought up, which I tried to highlight in my minute, some of the things of the reasons why this is happening and that it's not necessarily a bad thing. It could be kind of woven into the fabric of how
we
hear
a lot. I mean, we hear a lot that teacher turnover is bad for kids, that it suggests that school environments aren't doing a good job retaining teachers. So if charter school teachers are departing at a much higher rate than district teachers, is the natural conclusion that this shows that there's something wrong taking place in the charter sector?
No, I don't think it shows that something wrong. I mean, I think it shows that we need to rethink, and you brought the point earlier, how we think about teaching. Do we really expect them to stay in for 30 years? I mean, if we expect them to stay in 3 to 5 years, how are we going to change teacher training? How are we going to change our professional development models? I mean, the whole systematic approach needs to be geared differently if we find out that this is how teachers think about teaching and that they're staying in their short term.
How do we, is there any way to figure out whether the teachers who are leaving these charters, it's a good thing that they're being pushed out or that they're not simply passing the trash to another school?
They weren't able to determine whether or not the teachers were being let go because of performance, you know, and they kind of hypothesized that that wasn't happening, that when they looked at, you know, why teachers were leaving, it was more the school closed down or they had a reorganization or something of that nature. It wasn't that you were let go because you performed poorly.
And you would expect probably that turnover is greater in startup companies, for example, than in companies that have been around a long time. Mm-hmm. And so you see that here. I wonder what private school teachers, how that would play out, what that would look like in that sector.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the one thing they did look at, it was the difference between startups and conversion charters, and they found that it was higher turnover in the startup, which because the conversions tend to act more like traditional schools.
Can you look at the length of time charter has been operating?
He didn't in this study. Mm-mm.
I think we should give a shout out to the study's author, right?
David Stewart, yes, who's going to be an author of an upcoming report for Fordham.
Shout out, David.
He's Dale Ballew's PhD student.
Is he still at Vanderbilt?
He defended the summer.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. So what song goes along?
So since we're talking about turnover, we're going to have a 90s flashback with "Don't Turn Around" by Ace of Base. We all know this one.
I like it. Although, I have to say, I thought that song might have gone better with a study about school turnarounds.
Oh.
Critiquing my music.
Sorry. Like Andy Smerick's recent arguments, don't turn around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that. I like the way you're thinking.
Maybe we should do a little video of Andy, singing that song. I think that, Laura, let's put that on the schedule. Yep. All right. Well, now it's everyone's second favorite segment of the show. Stafford's Rate That Reform. I was really just kidding. It's not like we have any data on this. We just like to talk about how everybody does seem to like Amber's segment a lot.
Well, Amber certainly tells us she gets lots of fan mail.
Well, she does. I mean, that's undeniable.
Do you guys get approached by fans at events?
No.
Because I do.
See, that's that's the data point.
Are they creepy? Do they talk to you in that mic voice? Hey, Stafford.
I've been watching you.
No, they do not.
Don't pull down the shade.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm laughing on the inside. Okay, Stafford, what are we talking about today?
Today, we are talking about pregnant teens. Mackenzie McCollum had a tough senior season as the starting setter on her high school volleyball team. She goes to a high school in Fort Worth, Texas, and she's pulled off the volleyball court this fall when the school discovered that she was a few weeks pregnant. First blush, this seems like a completely reasonable decision if one assumes that the school was simply looking out for the health of baby and mother, and of course, protecting itself from a lawsuit. And of course, this would be quite a different story if we were discussing the headline, Pregnant Teen Loses Baby After Spiked in Stomach by Volleyball, which we are luckily not discussing. However, it seems that the girl who'd planned to keep the pregnancy quiet was outed by her coach at a team meeting, which the girl was not present. And the news, of course, quickly spread all over school. And once Mackenzie got back on the court, after she got the requisite doctor's note, which the school required, that said that she could play with, quote, no restrictions, her playing time was significantly cut by the coach, even though she'd been a starting setter and she'd typically played the full game pre-pregnancy. So pregnant female athletes, from amateurs to Olympic and professional competitors, have been wrestling with this exact question for many years. And so I went and I looked it up, and according to the Association of OBGYNs, women may continue to exercise even up to or a few days before they deliver, as long as they do not overexert themselves or participate in contact sports. So then the problem, of course, is mostly about perception. And unfortunately, this particular senior learned that the hard way. The girl's parents have now filed a civil lawsuit against the district claiming that under the rules of Title IX, their daughter was discriminated against because of her sex and because the school retaliated against her when the teen fought the suspension from the team. So I agree that the school was right to take Mackenzie off the court until she got a doctor's note. However, this was, you know, district policy, school policy. However, once Mackenzie did get the note that said she could play, the school should have followed its own rules. Instead, the coach cut her playing time, even though she was a starting player and previously played all game. And then the coach outed her to the team and de facto to the school, which is a violation of student medical privacy, not to mention a total jerk thing to do. So I gave the school a C- for, not for the policy, but for how it did not abide by the policy and then did not reprimand or discipline the teacher for violating the rules.
What happens here is we continue to kind of expand the boundaries of what we're going to permit in terms of behavior and the entitlements that we say kids have. Mm. And then if something goes wrong, the OBGYN guidelines say no contact. So it gets spiked by the ball, there's a health issue. Then it's how the hell could the school not have used good judgment about recognizing that there is some contact in volleyball if she collides with a teammate.
Well, I would agree with that, but I would add one caveat that she was a setter, which as a position is generally not a contact position. But I also just think that this is a matter of the school should, first of all, they say the doctor gets to make the decision, and then once the doctor says she's allowed to play, then the school says, no, you're not, we're going to cut your playing time, you're not allowed to play. I just, like, if you're going to make a policy, you're going to say the doctor makes the decision, then you should stick to the policy.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have. This is probably the last podcast of the year, Rick.
Oh, that's right.
What do you think? Because we're not going to be airing on Christmas Eve.
Everybody can understand and sympathize with.
I think that's right.
And then you're going to be, you're probably going to have a little bit of baby downtime, aren't
you? We got our own baby bump coming ourselves. That's right.
What's the due date here?
Wife is due on December 31st. She is, by the way, still exercising.
And yeah.
Though she feels a bit like a spectacle when she's on the elliptical at her gym. People come up to her and ask questions.
So Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you here, dog.
Likewise to you, Rick, and to all our listeners out there.
And Happy Hanukkah and Happy Kwanzaa and Happy everything else, too.
Look at you. I'm so impressed how inclusive you are.
Boom.
Rick. All right. Till next year.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show at edexcellence.net, signing off.